The Israel-Hamas war is taking its toll on hospital patients in Gaza who need to be evacuated.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday there's no reason why patients at Gaza's besieged Al-Shifa Hospital can't be safely evacuated.
Plus, Palestinian civilians and infrastructure topped the agenda at a summit in Saudi Arabia.
Arab and Islamic leaders met in the Saudi capital Riyadh, blasting the Israeli operation and its heavy toll on Palestinian civilians and infrastructure.
And the U.S. struck facilities used by Iran-affiliated groups in eastern Syria. Today is Monday, November 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Kim Lewis. In a statement, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the U.S. carried out strikes against a training facility near the city of Abu Kamal and a safe house near the city of Mayadeen. He said President Joe Biden ordered the strikes. Local sources also said the strikes targeted a camp run by pro-Iranian militias in an area west of Abu Kamal in Deir al-Zor province. The other strike was near a bridge close to the city of Mayadeen, near the Iraqi border, and a stronghold of pro-Iranian militias, the sources said. The strike is the third since October 26 as the U.S. attempts to quell wave after wave of drone and rocket attacks against American troops in Syria and Iraq, triggered by the Israel-Hamas war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that Hamas is blocking the safe removal of patients from a Gaza hospital. VOA's Rick Pantaleo has this report.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday there's no reason why patients at Gaza's besieged Al-Shifa Hospital can't be safely evacuated, but contended that Hamas militants are doing everything to keep them in harm's way. The Israeli leader told CNN's State of the Union show that 100 patients had been taken out of the hospital and that tens of thousands of Palestinians living in the immediate environs had moved out safely from the area along safe corridors heading south out of Gaza City. But Israeli-Hamas fighting continued near the hospital, Gaza's largest, and the hospital's director, Mohammed Abu Salmiya, says the facility was surrounded by conflict. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told CBS News' Face the Nation program that the U.S. does not want to see firefights in hospitals where innocent people, patients receiving medical care, are caught in the crossfire. Sullivan went on to say that active communications have been held with the Israeli Defense Forces on this. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Arab and Islamic leaders who held an extraordinary joint summit on Saturday in Saudi capital Riyadh condemned Israel's military operation in the Gaza Strip. Many of the leaders called for an immediate ceasefire and more aid into the territory. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says the Palestinian death toll has surpassed 11,000, overwhelmingly women and children. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
As Israel continued its military operation in the Gaza Strip, targeting Hamas for its October 7 attacks on Israel, Arab and Islamic leaders met in the Saudi capital Riyadh, blasting the Israeli operation and its heavy toll on Palestinian civilians and infrastructure. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who hosted Saturday's summit, used strong language to condemn Israeli military operations on Gaza. He says that we oppose this awful war in its entirety and its heavy toll on women, children, and the elderly, and on hospitals, places of worship, and civilian infrastructure. Saudi Arabia, he says, is working with its partners to put an end to this war, and we call for an immediate end to fighting and the opening of humanitarian corridors, in addition to the freeing of hostages and the innocent held by Hamas. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported the summit's resolutions call for the setup of an international war crimes tribunal and an end to any forced displacement of the Palestinian people inside Gaza or elsewhere, and an immediate ceasefire. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, whose visit to Saudi Arabia for Saturday's summit was the first by an Iranian president in more than a decade, claimed the Israeli military operation in Gaza was the worst crime witnessed in human history. Raisi went on to urge Arab and Islamic states to designate the Israeli army a terrorist group and to impose a boycott on Israel, including oil and other goods. He also demanded the establishment of a war crimes tribunal for both U.S. and Israeli leaders and officials who he claimed have committed war crimes in Gaza. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, using a more measured tone, called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the establishment of a Palestinian state in accordance with the borders of June 4, 1967, and with East Jerusalem as its capital.
إن مصر أدانت منذ البداية استهداف وقتل الأبرياء وترويع جميع المدنيين من الجانبين.
He says that Egypt has condemned the killing of the innocent since the outset, and we condemn once again this collective punishment of Gaza, including killings in the blockade and the unacceptable forced displacement of people, which he says cannot be justified as an act of self-defense. Sisi called on the international community and the UN Security Council to impose an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in Gaza and an end to any forced displacement of the Palestinian people, and for the international community to guarantee the security of civilians. He added that humanitarian aid must be allowed into Gaza and that Israel must bear its international responsibility as the occupying power to permit this passage of aid. Volker Turk, the UN human rights chief, who on Friday called Hamas' October 7 attack on Israel atrocious crimes, addressed the summit, decrying the war in Gaza and its human toll.
Across the Gaza Strip, more than 10,000 people have reportedly been killed, with the majority to be women and children. Many more are surely still under the rubble. The Israeli forces have pushed over 1.5 million people out of the north of the Gaza Strip.
It was not immediately clear what concrete actions the Arab and Islamic states were prepared to take to implement the resolutions or declarations made at Saturday's summit. Several Arab states, including Egypt, Jordan, and the United Arab Emirates, have diplomatic ties with Israel, while Iran, Syria, Lebanon, and Algeria do not. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The U.S. military says five crew members died when a helicopter crashed over the Mediterranean during a training exercise. VOA's Rick Pantaleo tells us more.
U.S. officials said on Sunday that five U.S. service people were killed when a military helicopter crashed over the eastern Mediterranean Sea during a training mission. The military's European command said all five crew members on board were killed when the aircraft went down during a routine air refueling mission as part of military training. The crash was first announced by the military on Saturday and said that the cause is under investigation, but there are no indications of any hostile activity involved. On Sunday, officials said that search and rescue efforts, including nearby U.S. military aircraft and ships, began immediately. The European command said that out of respect for the families of the service members and in line with U.S. Department of Defense policy, the identities of the crew members are being withheld for 24 hours until the families of those killed have been notified. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Russia's emergencies ministry said Sunday the evacuation of Russian nationals from the Gaza Strip has begun, and more than 60 Russian passport holders have crossed into Egypt. A limited evacuation to Egypt, which began on November 1st of foreign passport holders and Palestinians needing urgent medical treatment, has faced difficulties. British lawmakers and members of the upper house of parliament have called on the government to prescribe describe Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization, saying it would be a step toward restoring stability to the Middle East. Proscribing the IRGC as a terrorist group would mean it would become a criminal offense in Britain to belong to the group, attend its meetings, or carry its logo in public. U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Mike Johnson unveiled a Republican stopgap spending measure Saturday aimed at averting a government shutdown, but the measure quickly ran into opposition from lawmakers from both parties in Congress. Lawmakers have only a few days to agree to a bill and have President Joe Biden sign it into law by November 17th.
This is Science in a Minute.
Most living things on Earth require oxygen to survive. Our atmosphere, while containing mostly nitrogen, is also 21% oxygen as well. 96.5% of the toxic atmosphere of neighboring planet Venus is made up of carbon dioxide and has virtually no oxygen. In a joint project between NASA and the German Aerospace Center, scientists, for the first time, have detected a thin layer of atomic oxygen stuck between two other layers of the Venusian atmosphere on the day side of the planet. Atomic oxygen shouldn't be confused with breathable or molecular oxygen. Atomic oxygen contains one oxygen atom, while molecular or breathable oxygen is made up of two oxygen atoms. Researchers say the atomic oxygen on Venus is made when the sun's ultraviolet radiation breaks down atmospheric carbon dioxide and monoxide into oxygen atoms and other chemicals.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. Australia has signed a security, climate change, and migration accord with Tuvalu, a grouping of several low-lying coral reefs in the South Pacific Ocean. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us more.
For the first time, the Canberra government is offering residents facing displacement from global warming in other countries the opportunity to resettle in Australia. Tuvalu's government says rising sea levels pose an existential threat to its population of 11,000 people who live on nine low-lying islands. A new visa plan will allow 280 islanders to move to Australia each year. Analysts say the numbers are modest, but could increase if climate risks accelerate. There will also be funds for reclamation in Tuvalu to expand land in the capital Funafuti by around 6%. The archipelago lies about halfway between Australia and Hawaii. The announcement was made Friday by Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese at the Pacific Islands Forum in the Cook Islands.
The most significant agreement between Australia and a Pacific Island nation ever. The treaty covers three main areas of cooperation: climate change, human mobility, and security. Australia commits to provide assistance to Tuvalu in response to a major natural disaster, to a health pandemic, or to military aggression.
The agreement establishes Australia as Tuvalu's main security partner. While most Pacific Island countries have formal diplomatic relations with China, Tuvalu recognizes Taiwan. Australia is increasingly wary of Beijing's ambitions in the region. Last year, China signed an unprecedented security pact with the Solomon Islands, a strategically located archipelago northeast of Australia. Kauziya Natanu is Tuvalu's prime minister. He told reporters that his country also seeks good relations with China.
China came also to ask for diplomatic ties, and we said, yes, we agree. But because of their one China policy, they didn't allow us to have true diplomatic ties, you know, with Taiwan and them.
Analysts believe the accord is an attempt by Australia to increase its regional presence at a time when China is eager to expand its influence in the Pacific. Meg Keane is the director of the Pacific Islands Program at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based research organisation. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the accord boosts Canberra's security ties with Tuvalu.
What it does give us is visibility should they want to enter into an agreement as a sovereign state, which they are free to do, with, say, China and switch their allegiance from Taiwan to China or have some sort of security agreement with China. They should first let us know. And then, of course, there would be dialogue on that. It's not a veto that we get as a product of this.
On Sunday, Australia's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Penny Wong, reaffirmed Canberra's desire to increase its influence in the Pacific region, telling local media, "We recognise we live in a more contested region and we have to work harder to be a partner of choice." There has so far been no reaction from Chinese officials to Australia's bilateral accord with Tuvalu. The Falapili Pact is an agreement named after a Tuvaluan phrase, meaning good neighbourliness, care and mutual respect. Phil Mercer, VOA News, Sydney.
Evacuations are underway in Iceland as civil defense authorities prepare for a possible volcanic eruption. The decision follows increased seismic activity, indicating the flow of partially melted rock now underneath a fishing community. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Iceland declared a state of emergency as fears grow for a major volcanic eruption in Grindavik. Authorities evacuated people from this fishing town of about 4,000 residents after increased seismic activity began heading south. An indication that a corridor of magma or semi-molten rock now extends beneath the town. In recent days, scientists recorded thousands of earthquakes in Iceland, with some that tore apart roads and a golf course in Grindavik, an ominous sign of a possible volcanic eruption soon.
It cannot be ruled out that the magma tunnel that is forming could reach Grindavik. Police chief has decided, in consultation with the National Guard, to evacuate, and the National Guard simultaneously declared a state of emergency. The latest data show considerable displacement and a large magma tunnel forming that may open. This decision is made with the safety of the residents in mind.
The damage on and underground has Icelandic authorities on edge with memories of 2010. Back then, a massive volcanic eruption hurled chunks of rock while spewing smoke and ash. And while that eruption pumped smoke into the skies, it emptied them of air travel, grounding planes on a scale not seen since the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. That ash cloud rose as high as 11,000 meters, and the air travel disruptions between Europe and North America cost an estimated $3 billion through more than 100,000 canceled flights. Concerns of a possible eruption increased after a recent 4.8 magnitude earthquake hit the area, causing a temporary closure of the iconic Blue Lagoon geothermal resort. And as evacuees now seek shelter in aid centers, experts warn the 10 kilometers long underground magma corridor is spreading. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Students from Karabakh University in Kenya's Rift Valley have developed a method for turning grass into flour and then fortifying it for human consumption. This new flour will be an ingredient for ugali, a staple food normally made from cornmeal, since that grain has become too expensive for many families. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
You might think that Salome Njeri is clearing grass from her compound, but she is actually collecting raw materials to make flour. Njeri is among a group of four students at Kabarak University in Kenya's Rift Valley region who have come up with a way to turn the grass into flour. That flour can replace maize in the common Kenyan dish, ugali, at a time when many families are struggling with the high cost of living.
Considering the prices of maize flour, which is the staple food in Kenya, it has actually risen with above 50%, and we find that most people cannot be able to afford. Hence, we found a way out in which we can be able to make sure that food is actually affordable to each and every human being.
EcoStarch flour is made by converting grass to edible flour through enzymatic processes. The students have mostly been using Bermuda grass, but say any species of grass can work. As Innocent Bahati, a medical student at Kabarak University and one of the EcoStarch innovators, explains.
We cannot eat grass, right? But a cow can eat grass and digest it. So we found a way in which you can now convert the cellulose in grass, that is the bit you can digest, to become now starch, edible starch, using enzymatic transformation, using enzymes, so that we can get something that is similar to maize.
The harvested grass is cleaned and dried at room temperature to preserve nutrients. Next, it is ground into powder and then enzymes are added at specific temperatures for coloration. The mixture is then fortified with micronutrients and ready for human consumption. Kenya is among the sub-Saharan African countries experiencing alarming food crisis. The World Food Program says the number of people in urgent need of food assistance in the country has risen sixfold since 2020 to 4.4 million in February. Henry Kiplagat, the Vice Chancellor of Kabarak University, believes investing in innovation can help in solving the hunger situation.
Actually, most of the innovations in the world produced by young people, the age of university going students. It's very difficult to get a 100-year-old man or woman coming up with a new idea. So this is the future of the world, and we need to invest in them by setting aside resources to support their innovative work.
With the increasing threats from climate change and shocks on global supply chain systems, experts say African countries like Kenya should have homegrown solutions to the continent's food shortage problem. Michael Walehwa is a medical researcher and an associate lecturer at Kabarak University.
We can be able to come up with solutions that have been well researched upon and done so by researchers in our own country to be able to look at the safety of these products and work out the production costs so that we are able to produce products at rates that are relatively low.
After 3 years of research and trials, EcoStarch innovators are hoping to get a nod from authorities and get their product on the market. And by selling at a price 5 times lower than the average market price of maize flour, these student innovators hope to help less privileged families get ugali back on their dinner tables, albeit from grass. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Kabarak University, Kenya.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis, wishing you a good day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The disposition of the Abyei region on the border between Sudan and South Sudan has been a bone of contention between the two countries, even before South Sudan gained its independence in 2011. Both countries claim this oil-rich region. After the Second Sudanese Civil War ended in 2005 with the signing of a comprehensive peace agreement, a special status administrative region was created for the Abyei area. The exact borders of the region were to be determined by the Abyei Borders Commission. But the fighting over ownership of the territory continued. When hostilities ceased with a demilitarization agreement in 2011, the United Nations sent in a peacekeeping mission, UNISFA, with a mandate to keep Abyei demilitarized and weapons-free. In April, dialogue between Sudan and South Sudan finally looked promising, but it was interrupted by the armed conflict in Sudan. The belligerents put a stop to negotiations regarding the final status of Abyei and its borders. Today, Abyei is host to hundreds of South Sudan People's Defense Forces and South Sudan National Police Service personnel, as well as about 60 Sudanese oil police. The United States is concerned about the continued presence of South Sudanese and Sudanese armed groups in Abyei, said Robert Wood, United States Alternative Representative to the UN.
These forces present a destabilizing factor for civilians in Abyei and threaten Abyei's demilitarized status. UNISFA peacekeepers are the only force that should operate in Abyei. We call on all armed groups to depart the region and call on the governments of Sudan and South Sudan to instruct their forces to evacuate Abyei.
In two separate incidents, UNISFA personnel came under attack, first by suspected Sudan People's Liberation Movement and again by members of the Tuikdinka ethnic group. We condemn these attacks and call for the appropriate authorities to investigate them and hold the perpetrators accountable, said Ambassador Wood.
We strongly urge the government of South Sudan, with support from UNISFA, to foster a cohesive environment where the people of Abyei can live in peace and security.
We reiterate our commitment to work with the government of Sudan and South Sudan and the people in the region, our fellow council members, the African Union, and other international and regional partners to work towards peace, security, and prosperity in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.